Hey gang, Jinx here. I just wanted to take a couple of minutes of your time before we start the episode, if you wouldn't mind. This week's guest is Jerry Smith, who you might remember from our earlier Halloween 4 episode. As with before, I had a blast chatting with him, and I think we wound up with a fun conversation. I mean, we talked about Cobra; it kind of had to be a fun talk, right? And I gotta tell you, it was a relief to have that chat because up until that point, it had been not so great week, folks, for reasons that ultimately wound up paling in comparison to events that had yet to happen, certainly, but it reminded me of why I do this podcast in the first place. It's fun, you know, and I hope it's just as much fun for you to listen to, and that's why I wanted to take a brief moment before starting this episode, because it seems maybe a bit strange to me to be putting out a lighthearted conversation just after something truly tragic has happened. Not long after Jerry and I finished recording, word came that a member of the horror community had unexpectedly passed away. Dustin Pace was a cool artist with a unique style, and he was somebody that I only knew through Twitter. His handle was @DuddyInMotion, and if you get a moment, you should scroll through his feed and check out some of his work. I didn't interact with him often, but whenever I did, he always seemed to me to be an intelligent and passionate fan of the genre, and really, he mostly just struck me as being one hell of a nice guy. And given the response that's come in the wake of his passing, I'm certain that that was the case. You know, that he was a great person who died at an all too young age. And Dustin left behind a wife and family, and a GoFundMe memorial fund has been set up to help them with financial costs. If you can, please consider donating to it. It can be found at www.gofundme.com/dustin-pace-memorial-fund. And we'll also make certain to post that link in our show notes as well. I'd just like to offer, on behalf of all of us here at Screamatics, our deepest condolences to Dustin's family and friends. Anyway, we hope you enjoy the show and that it provides maybe, I don't know, a couple of laughs during an otherwise grim period.
In America, there's a burglary every 11 seconds, a violent crime every 25 seconds, a murder every 24 minutes, and 250 rapes a day.
Well, what are you waiting for? Let's go!
I don't deal with psychos. I put him away.
I ain't no psycho, man. I'm a hero of the new world.
Your disease, and I'm the cure.
Did you use unnecessary deadly force?
I used everything I had.
The serial killer has thrown the city into a growing panic, and up until now, no one has had a clue to his identity.
Do you think you would recognize me if you saw him again?
The tall one?
Yeah, the one that wants to kill you.
Do what you have to do to get a lead on this maniac.
And if I find him,
do what you do best.
You want your eyes, pig? You want to go to hell with me?
You won't shoot. Murder is against the law. You have to take me in. The court is civilized, isn't it, pig?
But I'm not. This is where the law stops. And I start. Sucker.
What can I say about Cobra? It is the greatest slasher that's often not appreciated as a slasher film. Sylvester Stallone against a group of satanic motorcycle-driving, van-driving, murderous, just evil men, headed by Brian Thompson as one of the best antagonists of all time. It is one of the best films of all time, a film so close to my heart. So many one-liners, so many just badass scenes. There is not a single thing wrong with Cobra, and I love it.
Hello, and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jinx, your host, and that was Jerry Smith talking about George P. Cosmatos' 1986 film, Cobra. Mr. Smith is the editor-in-chief of the website The Martyr Cycle and has written for Blumhouse, Daily Dead, Horror Hound, F This Movie, Shock Till You Drop, and Delirium, and acts as the unofficial booking agent for Scream Addicts. And in fact, he is our very first return guest. So, Jerry, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Dude, thank you so much for having me back on the show. I adore the hell out of your podcast.
Thank you very much for saying that. Now,
Before we get started with the question that kicks off every episode, I got to ask, just because I think we need to settle this before we go any further. of the two of us, who is the disease and who is the cure?
Oh, my God. You know, honestly,
just be honest.
I'd have to – I think I'm the disease, you know.
No.
I'd like to be the cure, but I don't know.
No. I'm no cure, so I'm just going to go ahead and throw that out there. Maybe we're both the disease and we're just waiting on Stallone to take care of us at some point. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, okay, as with every episode and every guest, I got to ask, you know what? Actually, maybe I won't get to this question because I must also ask, okay, this is a horror podcast about horror movies. And, you know, every guest chooses a horror movie to talk about. Sometimes the choices are along the lines of, you know, Halloween and Suspiria and A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Exorcist, you know. But then sometimes, just sometimes, we'll get a No Country for Old Men or Taxi Driver. And the guests make a point of not only talking about the films they've chosen, but also why they should be considered horror in the first place. You chose Cobra. You chose a Stallone action movie. What? Please tell us, in addition to why you chose this movie to chat about at length, how is it that Cobra could be considered horror?
How can it not be considered horror? It is about a satanic group of serial killers who stalk models, nurses, everyone, and just try to brutally murder them. I mean, if that's not horror, then I don't know what horror is.
You know, I actually agree entirely. I had remembered the movie as a kid, and I remember that had some scary sequences, but watching it again, you know, I'm ashamed to say that it had been quite a while since I'd revisited it, and watching it again, I was like, you know, it opens with a cult in this, like, grimy, you know, dingy sort of dungeon, like, clanging axes together, you know, so I was like, holy shit, okay, maybe he's right. This is absolutely a horror film, so...
Oh, yeah, definitely. And plus, I mean, man, that narration at the beginning, like, it scares the hell out of you. You know, in America, there's a burglary every 11 seconds, an armed robbery every 65 seconds, a violent crime every 25 seconds, a murder every 24 minutes, and 250 rapes a day. Like, if that's not something that scares the hell out of you right from the beginning, then, yeah, I mean...
And people like
no
the
80s. There's no way that Cobra's not a horror film.
What is it with the nostalgia... You know, and the 80s, if that's what was going on in the 80s, like, I want to check those stats against, like, today's numbers. Like, because they just present a hell, you know, in this movie. It just seems awful. Like, I pair that with, like, you know, the city scene in, you know, RoboCop or RoboCop 2. I remember being a kid living in, you know, Southern Ohio, much as I am. Right now, all these years later, but I growing up in the country and watching these movies about the big city, I was just like, I am never going there. I'm never
right.
My God, like you, I wouldn't last 10 minutes. So yeah.
Oh man, like I've lived in California my entire life, and as a kid, when I heard those statistics, I was scared to go outside of my door. I mean, dude, 250 rapes? That's scary.
But, you know, we have Stallone to protect us, or at least so the movie says. And I got to say, you know, watching it again, I mean, the movie was made in 1986. In a way, it is the perfect 1980s movie because, I mean, yeah, on the one hand, it is a slasher movie, and it is absolutely a slasher movie. And when I think of the 80s as a horror movie fan, my mind immediately goes to slashers. But it's also... Mm-hmm. Such an 80s action movie. I mean, Stallone's the star, and he's a complete 80s action hero. And it's like those two things were just sort of welded together. You know, they have no real reason to exist together.
Not at all.
Like, but
not at all.
And, but they do, and it's kind of brilliant.
We can't forget Cannon's involvement in this, too.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And isn't it like Golan Globus, I think, too, like, produced it? So...
Yeah.
It's so 80s. It is the 1980s movie, I think. I would stand by that. I can't think of another movie that 80s harder than Cobra.
Oh, definitely. And plus, I mean, it has those kind of like really awful cliches. Like, you know, the main protagonist, you know, trying to be a badass, but has like, you know, a not so badass real name, you know, Marion, you know, and... His last name's Cobretti, but he wants to be so tough that he just changed it to Cobra, and he has a Cobra on his gun, and he wears aviators and gloves. I mean, it screams 80s to me.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, could you imagine any action star? And I don't even know if action stars are a thing these days, unless, you know, they were an action star in the 80s to begin with. But, I mean, could you imagine any lead actor in an action movie these days trying to pull off any of what Stallone does in this movie and it not seeming like a parody?
Oh, it would come off like MacGruber.
Yeah. Very true. God, I kind of want to see that. That would be a hell of a team.
Right?
You know, but it's funny, you know, even watching, I wonder, I mean, by that point, how long had that sort of genre existed? I mean, how many of those movies had Stallone already been in? And I mean, when we first see him, he steps out, he's already almost a parody of 80s action heroes, you know, with that that sort of vintage car and, oh God, the license plate, Awesome 50. You know, he's chewing the match and, you know, there's his nickname, which is the name of the movie. And there's his, you know, going on later into the movie, he has the one-liners and the Cobra illustration on the grip of his gun. And even later, like, just weird moments, like him watching cartoons in his apartment,
yeah,
which is cluttered.
With the pizza.
Yeah, but also antiseptically sort of, like, white at the same time. And he's cutting pieces of pizza up with scissors while, you know, tending to his gun. Like, but what's crazy is I think all of it's amazing because Stallone plays him so straight. And given how kind of absurd his character is, one feels that he either, you know, he wrote the movie and he starred in the movie, but it feels like he either wasn't in on the joke or maybe, and I think this is more likely, I think he knew that the most effective way to play that guy was to play him straight, you know? And given that Stallone, I think, is a smart guy and he's a smart actor, he's a smart storyteller, I have to imagine that's the case. But I have to believe on some level that there was a little bit of parody going on straight away, you know?
Well, what I think happened, I mean, I'm sure you know this. I'm sure anyone that is a big fan of Cobra knows this. I mean, Stallone was originally signed on to play Axel Foley in Beverly Hills Cop.
Which is weird.
You know, I know.
Almost it was weird to imagine that David Cronenberg was going to direct that movie at one point, or at least he was considered for it.
I know.
It's bizarre.
That would have been great. But, I mean, you know, Stallone messed with the script and had all these things that, you know, he insisted on. And, you know, wanted it to be this massive action movie. And, you know, obviously the studio didn't want the same thing. So, you know, he still wanted to do Beverly Hills Cop. So he just got Paula Gosling's book Fair Game and made it into Cobra, which I think is funny because Cobra's basically the direction he wanted to take Beverly Hills Cop. And I'd like to sit back and think of a Beverly Hills Cop that would have been Cobra. I mean, Axel Foley, you know, going against satanic motorcycle gangs.
I would still watch that movie.
Like, oh, me too.
I would still watch a movie where Eddie Murphy and Stallone teamed up to take on like a new version of that gang. That would be Oh yes. Well, why not? Nostalgia is huge these days, so why not bring back? You know, it's funny when he was doing like Rocky Balboa, and there was a rumor at one point that his fourth Rambo movie was just going to be called John Rambo. I remember somebody online just being like, "When are we getting Marion Cobretti? You know, when are we getting like the really grim version of Cobra where he's an old man, but he's still kicking ass, you know?"
Well, on Stallone's Instagram this year, and I'm not a stalker or anything, but I am writing a book on Cobra, so I got to know my stuff. This year, Stallone posted on his Instagram, you know, just a picture, if I recall correctly, a picture of him just hanging out by the Cobra car and kind of a question mark or something like that. And, like, I don't know if that means he's going to reboot Cobra or what's going to happen or if we're finally going to get a director's cut or what. But, I mean, if he brought back Cobra, I would be on board in a split second.
What do you think you know, because the movie is so very 80s, and that's part of what it's – now, here's the thing, if I can go ahead and prepare you. I'm going to say a lot of things during this podcast probably that sounds like I'm bashing the movie, but I want you to understand that everything that I say that sounds like I'm bashing the movie, it's all actually stuff that makes me love the movie, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
I'm the same way. I'm the same exact way.
But I just wonder, like, you know, the movie is so very 80s in a way. I wonder how you could take that character and put him in modern times without strip. I mean, you know, he did it before. I mean, with the fourth Rambo movie, he sort of did away with the superheroics of like Rambo 2 and Rambo 3. And I guess with Rocky, he sort of did the same thing. I mean, it's weird to imagine that Rocky Balboa was a follow-up in any way to Rocky 3 and Rocky 4, you know? But
right.
But at Rocky the same time, like, how do you take Marion Cobretti and put him in the present day, you know? And does
– Oh, I've got it. I'm on top of that, Jinx.
Hit us.
Stallone, call me. I got my pitch ready right now.
He listens, actually.
Okay. Here we go.
He doesn't listen.
Cobra is ready to go. He's up there in age, but he's still trucking along, being part of, you know, the zombie crew. And instead of the satanic motorcycle gang in the 80s, we have really awful millennial murderers fronted by Jared Leto, because who doesn't want to kill that dude? So basically, Cobra would go against the most annoying hipster millennials around, and it would be great. That's my take on it.
Cobra because, would, you know, not Stallone's fare well really on Twitter.
Big. No, it wouldn't. you know, Stallone obviously likes to take on, you know, things that are relevant these days, you know, with like the Burma stuff and Rambo. Why not take out all of those millennials with Cobra 2?
Now, would it still be a horror film?
Ramen would be saved.
Yeah, it's funny that you just mentioned something. You mentioned the zombie squad that he's a part of, and you know, yeah. Looking at the movie, I mean, yeah, we have slashers as villains, and we even have Andrew Robinson in the movie, the friggin' Scorpio killer. Larry and Uncle Frank from Hellraiser is a straight-laced cop in this movie, and kind of an asshole, admittedly. But, I mean, still, the fact that he's in it at all, I mean, it's kind of crazy. As a horror fan, I was just like, wait a second. But, you know, we have the character working on something that's dubbed the Zombie Squad, which is apparently comprised of specialists who take the jobs that nobody else wants. And I got to ask you, because, again, I hadn't seen the movie in a very long time, and watching it again, you know, I was taking notes during it. And I got to ask, did I miss it? Do we see any other members of the Zombie Squad in this movie?
We don't. I mean, I don't know if Gonzalez is supposed to be a member, but I mean,
he's not a member of the Zombie Squad.
I think Cabretti's the only member. Maybe he is the Zombie Squad.
Well, I just wonder. I mean,
like they give it to him. They give it to him just to, like, you know, make him happy. I don't know.
I that could have made for such a great franchise, you know, like a good shared universe set of movies, you know, if only they had thought that way back in the 80s. You know, Cobra could have started things off. Yeah, we could have gotten
the
like all
could
these
be called Zombie Squad.
Yeah, no. I think Cobra starts off the franchise. That's our Iron Man, right? And then we meet all of the other members of the Zombie Squad in their own one-off movies. And then every three or so years, we'd get a Zombie Squad.
Obviously.
Oh, God, absolutely. How could I mean, it would essentially be the Expendables, only when they were all young.
Yeah. But it'd have to be Dolph Lundgren during his, like, dark hair era.
Yeah, he'd have to be, like, Punisher Dolph Lundgren, not a...
Yeah,
not,
I Come in Peace.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's a great movie, actually.
It is.
I adore that movie. I got to say, I actually, a lot of Dolph Lundgren's stuff, I don't know if he was ever really considered on the same tier as some of the biggest action heroes back in the day. But honestly, looking at his little run, I would hold that above most of the other movies of, say, certainly Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
Arguably, well, maybe not Van Damme, but I dug Lundgren quite a bit.
Well, you know, I'm not trying to piss anybody off, but I would put Dolph Lundgren's filmography above Van Damme's any day of the week. I mean, Van Damme's really good at doing splits and kicking people and sound, like, looking really intense, but Dolph Lundgren could actually act. I mean, he's pretty good.
I will say that Van Damme was pretty good at emoting, but Van Damme also had, like, a real run of stinkers, like, in the late 90s that I don't think he's ever really recovered from.
I mean, you can't tell me that watching Dolph Lundgren hold up that necklace full of ears and saying, "I'm all ears," shouldn't have been nominated for an Oscar or at least a blockbuster award.
Now, that's a horror movie, Universal Soldier. Yeah. That movie terrified me as a kid, even though it was an action movie. So, yeah, I would totally watch a Zombie Squad franchise, even today. So, honestly, I just want to know who the hell the rest of them were, and were they given as much shit as Cobra was from, you know, their commanding officers.
I'd like to, if they ever did a spinoff of Cobra and it was the Zombie Squad, I'd like to see a lot of the cast members from Cobra come back. I mean, Andrew Robinson, Art LaFleur, I think it'd be great.
I would watch it. I would still watch it. I just got to wonder what book they're going to use as the basis for the follow-up, though. Because you did mention, I mean, the movie is based on the novel Fair Game by Paula Gosling, which... listeners out there, this is a horror show, so I'm not entirely certain if you might know this. I'm sure some of you will, but Fair Game, which acted as the basis for Cobra, also inspired a movie of the same name in the 90s, starring in the Stallone role, Billy Baldwin, and in the role originated by Bridget Nielsen, Cindy Crawford. And honestly, there is no reason that you should remember that movie, because it is well, Jerry, tell him.
Well, you know, I have to be brutally honest with myself about this one. I went to see Fair Game opening night, not because I was a big Cobra fan, which I was, or not because I knew the novel, which I did, but because I was a horny teenager, and every news place said that Cindy Crawford got naked in the movie. That's all I remember about the movie, other than wanting to leave halfway through. That's all I have to say about Fair Game. Sorry, guys.
No, hey, I that's completely fair. I was 13 when the movie came out, and that was pretty much the only reason I stuck through it till the end, too. So, yeah, it's not a great movie, but it is kind of fascinating that two so completely different movies can be based from the same source material. And it's funny, doing a little bit of research on this before this talk, Paula Gosling did write the original novel. That original novel was used as the basis for Cobra. And, Jerry, I know you're writing a book, and I definitely want to talk about your book about Cobra here very shortly. But correct me if I'm wrong about any of this with the research that you've done. But as I understand it, she wrote the book. The book was picked up to be adapted. And then Stallone basically grafted all of his unused ideas from Beverly Hills Cop onto the plot of her novel. And that's why we have Cobra. But is this hearsay or not? Did Stallone actually try and push for a reissue, like a movie tie-in edition of the Paula Gosling novel with his name?
Written by him, right?
That's insane!
Yeah.
He wanted to take credit for a novel that he adapted after he adapted it. Like, what? How was his star so big at that time that he thought that that might actually happen?
I really think it was. You know, this was at a time where, I mean, Stallone was, I mean, he was on top of his game as far as, you know, being an A-list action star. And, you know, maybe it went to his head. We'll have to see. Yeah, I'm writing the book, and we can get into that whenever you want. But, I mean, I haven't spoken to Stallone yet, emphasis on the yet, but that is definitely something I want to address and talk to him in detail about.
How are you? Okay, we can't probably. Okay, listeners out there, I promise we're going to dive into the horror movie portion of Cobra soon. But I got to ask, because it's right here and I got to know. Like, I like Stallone. I think he's a very good actor when he tries. I mean, obviously some of his movies, especially back in his action movie heyday, some of them were duds, and it's obvious that he phones some stuff in. But there's a lot of stuff in his filmography that is fantastic. I think he's a great writer and director. But it's weird being a fan of his and being excited to see any new movie that he puts out. And I admit that freely. It's weird being a fan of him and then going back and reading some of these stories about him, like he wanted to take the author's name off and replace it with his own. Or, you know, there are these persistent stories about how, you know, no member of a crew on a movie he's working on can look him in the eye. You know, stuff like that. And I'm like, it kind of kills the fan in me to hear stuff like that. And I'm wondering, like, if he is that kind of personality, how are you going to go about broaching some of these subjects, like, you know, the novelization? How are you going to go about dancing around some of that stuff when you're sort of posing those questions?
I honestly don't plan on dancing around anything.
I guess I should ask then, how long do you expect the interview to go on for?
I don't know, 2 minutes? No. something happened very early on in the process of putting this book together that made me realize how not only special it will be, but falls out weird. And that's when I first talked to Brian Thompson about being a part of the book. And he said something that really just stayed with me. And he said, yeah, I'd love to, as long as you print every story I tell you.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, no. And that's pretty much all I can say about that.
Have you already talked to him?
You know, I can't say who I've talked to or how far along it is, but I've talked to some people, and there's definitely going to be a good amount of wild insanity in this book.
Yikes.
If you think the movie's crazy and weird, everything that went on, it's going to be nuts.
Is there going to be a film adaptation of the book you're writing, like The Disaster Artist, you know, on that level? Could it be something like that eventually?
Yeah, maybe James Franco will play Brian Thompson.
Holy shit, I would watch that movie.
Right.
So what inspired you to dive in and write a book about? Is it simply the making of Cobra that you're writing about, or is it just are you tackling a number of different subjects related to the movie and its making? Or
it's primarily, I'd say it's about 95% about Cobra. I mean, because my history with that film goes back to me being, you know, like 6 years old, seeing it for the first time. And just it being such a crazy, weird, profound experience for me. But, I mean, my style of writing, some people don't like it, but my style of writing has always been kind of like, you know, put all the blood on the page and make it very personal. And so it will be about the making of Cobra, but at the same time, it'll also be about, you know, my personal experience with the film and how I feel about it. And, you know, even coming at it not just as an author, but as an insanely huge fan of the film.
Very cool. I for one cannot wait to check it out. I think it'll be pretty great. And good luck with the Stallone interview. I was joking earlier. I'm sure it'll wind up being great. Just maybe, I don't know if I could suggest, if I dare suggest one thing, maybe hold all of the really touchy questions till like the very, very end.
That way I could crawl away with a broken nose after the good stuff's been recorded.
As long as you get as much material from as possible before you actually look into his eyes and start posing some of those questions, you should be good. So, fingers crossed. Will it – sorry I'm harping on this so much, but I think it's kind of fascinating.
Okay.
Will you actually be talking to him like one-on-one, or will it be like a phone interview, or have you even been told how this can happen?
It hasn't been confirmed what format or what exactly will, you know, take place as far as in person or on the phone. But, I mean, I wouldn't have taken the book on unless I felt that the most crucial people involved would be able and willing to be a part of it. And, I mean, at this point, I feel like everyone that I have on board is extremely crucial to the film. I mean, like I said, I can't really say more than that as far as that, but... anyone who loves the film or loves films from that era, they're gonna be excited.
Excellent. And is there a tentative release date for it?
Not yet. I mean, I'm still working on it. We just kind of got into the whole announcement and contract of the book. Within the last couple months. It happened very fast, actually, and it all happened because of Lee Gambin, who is an excellent author and film journalist. He's written for Fangoria, so many places. And he just came out with a new book about the making of Cujo. He's working on one about Christine. He wrote a book on 70s musicals. Lee Gambin is just a force of nature. And he pretty much facilitated this whole thing for me. And I owe him a lot. And, like I said, it happened really fast. So, it's still early on in the whole process.
Okay, very cool. All right, so back to Cobra, the movie, as it were, and the horror elements. So, again, watching it again, it opens with a cult brandishing axes. And then pretty early on, we find out that this cult has sort of been laying waste to just various poor victims throughout the city before we find out that there is essentially a figurehead to this group, and that is the killer known as the Night Slasher. And
yeah. The
Night Slasher is a total horror movie villain. It's right there in his name. He's a slasher. You know, he even has a mask, although I think it's his mask is like heavier duty.
The pantyhose.
Yeah. But still, you know, it's a mask. And I got to say, what he lacks in a cool mask, he totally makes up for with a pretty kick-ass weapon. That knife is incredible.
Oh, my God. Right. Let me just talk about how I got into the film, because the Night Slasher is a huge part of why I fell in love with Cobra. When the film came out, my dad didn't take me to see it in the theater, which really bummed me out because I went to see everything in the theater as a kid. That was my thing. So what my dad used to do was play the most cruel tricks on me and take me to the video stores the day that whatever I wanted to watch came out on video. And every single time he would go and be like, you know what, you look at the Nintendo games, you know, Excitebike or, you know, Metroid, whatever you want to look at, and I'll go ask the clerk for the movie. And every single time he would come back and be like, oh, well, son, it looks like somebody checked it out. And I would start crying every time because I was a little kid. And you'd think that I would learn my lesson in, like, and, you know, after that happening 5 or 10 times, but he would do it every time and I'd fall for it. And the same thing happened with Cobra. Wanted to see it so bad. I was in love with that poster that I saw at the movie theater. You know, everything. I mean, that movie just clicked for me. It was everything that I wanted to watch. And so he was like, oh, they don't have it. And I was, you know, crying, bummed out. You know, why don't you go rent another movie? So obviously, I just ran a short circuit for like the 50,000th time, I think. it might have been short circuit. I can't remember. But, yeah, we got home. I didn't want to watch whatever, you know, we had rented because, I mean, it was Cobra for me, and that's all I wanted to see. And so what we did was my dad would put on he would put on what I thought was a movie that we rented, but was in reality Cobra because they did have it, and my dad was just a dick. and so I'd be thrown a fit, you know, pissed off that, you know, I wasn't about to watch the movie that I wanted to watch. And eventually, you know, that opening scene, which is scary as hell, and then that narration and all that stuff came on, and it scared the hell out of me. It, to this day, it's probably scarier than any slasher movie that I saw growing up, as far as, you know, me being that young and leaving an impression. I mean, obviously, it's not that scary these days. But being that young and seeing Brian Thompson in those pantyhose and a huge knife that's just as punk rock and metal and just evil as it gets, and his delivery of every line is so terrifying. I mean, I will go to my grave saying that Brian Thompson's Night Slasher role is one of my favorite villains in any film, let alone any horror film. I love it. I mean, at the end, he has that whole monologue, you know, like, do you want to go to hell with me, pig? And he's spitting every time he says pig. And, oh, my God, that guy is just, he's amazing in that movie. I think, you know, obviously Stallone, top billing, of course. And when you think of Cobra, oh, Stallone. But I don't think Brian Thompson gets enough credit because, I mean, without Brian Thompson, I don't think Cobra would be as good as it is.
Yeah, I agree. And I think he is... I think he's a very underrated actor. Like, he had a great look, and it seems like he was always playing villains. Like, I recall him being like the alien bounty hunter in, you know, the X-Files. But, you know, and maybe that pigeonholed him a little bit as an actor, but he does give a really terrifying performance in the movie, and I think he cut one hell of a figure. You're right, that final sort of monologue at the end when he's spitting pig out at the end of every single sentence, you know, it's... He's terrifying because he seems like just purely evil. And
there's no motive.
No. And I did a little bit of reading on that, too. Apparently, like, he was, you know, as an actor, he wanted that sort of backstory to fuel him. And apparently, like, Stallone just told him, no, you're just evil, you know. And so that's all he played. But my God, I mean, he was still able to make something pretty amazing out of that. And as a result, like, he really terrified me as a kid when I saw that movie. And it was around the same time. For whatever reason, I always confused the two. But are you familiar with Jeff Kober, who played the villain in The First Power?
And, yes. Yeah. Well, no, The First Power is one of my favorite films of all time. I love
Buddy
Jeff
Boy.
Kober.
You know, like, God, he's so great.
Right?
In that. That's a fun movie,
Gary
too.
Gary Ross, yeah.
Those two always
that.
Struck me as being, like, essentially the same guy. I think, I don't know, I think the 80s missed the boat on trying to put those two in a movie together as, like, evil, you know, murderous brothers. But
it's the devil, man. Brings out the best in you.
But yeah, Thompson, I agree. Thompson is really fantastic. And you know the
And you know what? Another kind of unsung, not hero, but I guess villain, Lee Garlington.
God,
I mean,
you just,
you know,
hate her.
When she isn't, you know, pretending to be the nice cop in those scenes where she's just evil and her hair is kind of like everywhere, like, she's pretty spooky too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny, like, you know, you think about Thompson in the movie being he's essentially the main villain. But the fact that it is, you know, there are so many other villains in the movie, including her. I mean, and the cult that they're in is portrayed as almost this omnipotent force at times, you know, like they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Just look for the tattoo. And it feels like very Race with the Devil at times. The fact that this cult can be yes. anybody you know, and that they're always watching and they're always on your heels. And it, again, yeah, I mean, it does feel like an 80s action movie at times. But when the cult comes to the fore, it does get quite creepy at times.
Yeah, it definitely. And I mean, that scene, the first murder that the cult does, it's spooky stuff. I mean, I've only heard, you know, rumors and, you know, legend of all of this stuff that was cut out of the original film, you know, and from what, you know, from everything I've researched and stuff, I mean, there's a lot of just craziness that the cult, I mean, actually did in the original cut of the film that was never released. But I mean, man, I'd love to see that stuff. I'd love to have more about the cult and more about, you know, all the craziness that went on.
It even feels like, too, like there's a lot of, and I don't know that there was. I mean, I know that the movie was cut down quite a bit, you know, like some of the subplots were excised to get it down to like 90 minutes. But I wonder if a lot of gore didn't hit the cutting room floor, too, because there are sequences in it that are still kind of upsetting and kind of disturbing in their own right. But it feels like, you know, there are sequences in this movie that feel like a chopped up early Friday the 13th sequel where you're certain
yeah.
that they shot something really horrendous and we didn't get to see it. Well,
I know that there were like some access to the face of different people. And, you know, like some of the hospital people, like their murders were actually filmed and stuff. So, I mean, I do think so. I think maybe if that picture that Stallone posted earlier this year was of a director's cut, I mean, you know, because he's notorious for doing those in the last few years. I mean, you got, like, you know, the director's cut of, you know, Rambo that was even more gruesome than the theatrical. And, you know, you get, you know, the extended version of Expendables that was crazier. I wouldn't put it past him to go back and, you know, release Cobra with all that stuff in, especially since it's been revealed that he basically directed the film.
Really?
Well, it kind of, you know, there's that whole thing where, you know, Kurt Russell really directed Tombstone, and he told George, you know, that he wouldn't admit to it till he died. And, you know, from different people's firsthand accounts, you know, Stallone basically called the shots on Cobra because, you know, he knew what he wanted, and, you know, George directing it wasn't important enough for Stallone to let George direct it, you know? That's another thing I'd really like to talk to Stallone in detail about, in depth about, you know, because, I mean, there are so many rumors and legends with Cobra that a lot of people just don't understand. And I think it's important to get to the bottom of those and actually see which ones are real, which ones aren't, you know, and all that stuff. And if Stallone did call the shots like so many people say he did, and, I know that for a fact that some people say that he directed the film, you know, I'd like to know the details on that. You know, and I'd like to know, you know, will we ever see that footage? Will we ever see the, you know, the cut that was rated X at first because it was so gruesome? You know, because I think that would make the movie, yeah, I mean, the movie's cheesy as hell at times, but I think coming out with that stuff maybe would get those people that have always, you know, fought tooth and nail to say, no, Cobra's not a horror film. Maybe it would get them on board of being like, okay, this is a really gruesome film that was kind of chopped down a little bit, but look at this cut. You guys are going to love it.
I would totally watch that. It seems like, I don't know, something that Scream Factory might put out, or Arrow. It seems like it's calling out for, yeah, a big special edition that sort of restores all of that stuff. And that would be pretty great if that happened. And, you know, I mean, what was it? Warner Brothers, I think they put it out. So, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, if we can get a director's cut of Nightbreed, then I don't think
yeah.
that getting a longer cut of Cobra is entirely out of the question.
No, I mean, we even got, even if there was a re-release of Cobra and they released a work print as a special feature, kind of like we got with The Exorcist 3 in Scream Factory, you know, I'd be satisfied with that just because I'd like to see the film as it was intended. If they didn't have if they didn't have, you know, the budget or whatever to fully restore it, you know, as long as they released the original film in like a really nice collector's edition and gave us a work print at least, you know, I'd be satisfied with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially, I mean, I would just like to see what we're missing in some of those gore scenes, just to, you know, to see what they were originally intended to look like, I think that would be pretty neat. And, you know, I could only imagine that popping those back in would make it seem like even more of a slasher film, you know, even more of a horror film. And, you know, which again, I mean, you know, not that the movie doesn't seem like that at times, too. I mean, there are sequences in the movie that, you know, the murder scenes play out like horror movie scenes. And, you know, there's some great tension and frights throughout. You know, I'm thinking like of that hospital sequence. You know, it plays out like a mini Halloween 2 with, you know, Bridget Nielsen playing like a way more buff Laurie Strode. I mean, you know, and not, I mean, she's a good actress. I think she actually gives a really good performance in this. But at the same time, it's really hard to kind of buy her as a damsel in distress at times because, like, it looks like she could snap most of the cast in half if she wanted to. But, it seems like she's towering over most people, including Stallone, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, she's a goddess in that movie. She's tall as hell. I mean, I don't know why she didn't fight him at the end.
Yeah. But, you know, they definitely do portray her as kind of a damsel in distress at times, too. But, I mean, at the same time, you know, if she is meant to be kind of like the victim in this story, I mean, it's – you can't help but feel bad for this poor woman because not just the fact that, you know, the night slasher's on her heels and not just because there's an entire cult trying to wipe her off the face of the earth, but she is – essentially, you know, saddled with potentially the worst protector that any action or horror movie ever had. You know, when he takes her out of the hospital, when they're, you know, sort of porting her over to the safe house or whatever, there's an attempt on her life by a car full of killers. And instead of getting her back to safety, Cobra basically buckles her in and he pursues a car full of killers, firing shotguns at them. With his key witness in the passenger seat, you know, but you know, I guess it's cool because he fires back at them with an automatic weapon, like he's the craziest cop that any movie ever saw, I think. But you know, it's just I love the absurdity it's like in the that, movie.
It's like that 80s action film syndrome where, I mean, there's no common sense. he has the witness that they're trying to protect right next to him, and like basically. There's so many times in the film that he puts her in the line of danger. And, I mean, it's like you said earlier, there's all these things that, I mean, it might sound like you're, you know, trashing the film, but you're not at all, because these are all, like, silly things that make it even more lovable.
All of that stuff endears it to me even more, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even just stuff that doesn't happen in the movie makes me love it. I mean, can you imagine Cabretti going to the gun shop and saying, you know, I hate my last name, but I call myself Cobra. Can you put a cobra on the handle of my gun? I mean, like, those are the things that I always thought about, you know?
Oh, totally. And, you know, the movie does have, like, this, it's not very apparent at times, but it does have this streak of kind of loopy humor in it, you know? And, you know, there is some cheesiness there, but also, I mean, but yeah, like the French fry scene, for example, like there's a weird sort of humor where, okay, the characters are having kind of a heart to heart, you know, he and Nielsen's character. And, you know, he makes this weird sort of note about her drowning her French fries in ketchup. And then, you know, eventually they get into talking about, you know, the type of person he might wind up with. And he says something like, anybody who'd wind up with me would have to be a little crazy. And she just kind of nods. And then she proceeds to spray like another gallon of ketchup on her fries. And it cuts to this weird look of his like, you know, maybe this woman is crazy, you know. And it's such a weird moment to drop into a movie like this. But there are a few instances, I think, throughout that are kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the whole movie is ridiculous. I mean, you know, like they're trying to flirt with each other in that scene, and, you know, he's just like touching bobbleheads. And I mean, it's like, dude, you're supposed to be a badass. Put the moves on this girl. I mean, why are you messing around with bobbleheads? I mean, he's like this, you know, badass in aviators and, you know, gloves and this crazy, you know, awesome gun, and he doesn't know how to talk to a woman.
Yeah, well, you know, they do portray him, too, as being kind of a I don't know if he's meant to be the sharpest character because he catches the Lee Garlington character making a phone call to the cult. And, you know, he doesn't completely catch her red-handed, but he asks all of the questions you would to basically point out that, hey, she shouldn't be out there making that call at this time of night when they're essentially in hiding. And it pretty much spells out to the audience that, hey, he knows something's going on. So it's like, oh, okay, so is he going to spirit his witness out, you know, under cover of night along with his partner and get away from this clearly dirty cop who has tipped off the cult? No. He goes back to the room and he cleans his guns. And, you know, and, you know, there's the inevitable love scene with Nielsen's character. It's like, did that completely fly over his head then? The fact that, you know, they've just had this cult of killers called down upon their heads by, you know, somebody who's meant to be working with them?
Well, there's no logic whatsoever at all in this entire film, and that's what makes it so great.
So we were talking about some of the more horrific aspects of the movie, and, you know, a lot of those are confined to the story. You know, the fact that there are, you know, cult members and a serial killer and, you know, some really horrific murder scenes. But, you know, watching the movie again, speaking of creepy, speaking of terrifying, there are some amazing stunts in that final chase scene, but I'm pretty sure that some of those stunt people may have died while filming them.
Right? I've always felt the same exact way. Like, every time I watch that movie, from the first time when I was sitting around 6 years old to, like, now, you know, I'm in my late 30s, I cannot watch that movie without hurting for every one of those stuntmen. That whole chase scene just looks so painful. I'm sure, like, at least one person had to go home or go to the ER with, like, a broken neck.
You know, all of the action in it is incredible. There is one shot where a guy goes careening off of a motorcycle. And or maybe he's tossed off the back of the truck while it's still moving. And that's impressive enough. But then there is this reverse shot of him tumbling in the road with like a dozen motorcycles racing at what appears to be top speed right at the truck. And there are like two bikes that have to veer away and miss him. And they do. But it's like, you know, part of me is still in the movie watching it going like, oh. You know, but another part of me is kind of like the guy who loves watching behind the scenes, you know, footage from the making of certain movies or whatever. Part of me is looking behind the curtain while watching it, thinking that stunt guy nearly fucking got his head taken off by that bike. Like, it's amazing that they were able to do that.
Well, there's two things. Part of me is still that kid that tries to think of, you know, backstories and what happens in the future of characters, even though they're the minor characters. You know, on one end, I could picture the dude with broken bones waking up in the ER going, man, I should have really, you know, given second thought about being in that cult because now I have no arm, you know? And the other thing, like, every time I see that same shot that you're talking about, it reminds me of that scene in Mad Max. I don't know if you know which one I'm talking about, where the guy on the motorcycle just does the crazy flip.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Totally.
I can't watch Cobra and some of those stunts without thinking of Mad Max for some reason. I don't even know why that is.
I'd like to think that it's the same stunt guy.
Yeah, he's just like screwed by this point in his life. Like he can't even like walk. I mean, a wheelchair is too good for him.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that is pure 80s action movie too. The fact that there could even be practical stunts like that, you know, at all. And, you know, like a lot of other 80s action movies, inevitably, you know, when the movie winds down, we wind up in this great abandoned industrial setting for the end.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why so many movies wind up in abandoned factories that are still operating without anybody there. Like, there's still shit going on and moving around in the background, but, you know.
It's like Cobra, RoboCop, Terminator 2. Like, doesn't anyone work there?
Yeah. You know,
In Elm Street 2, does anyone work at these places?
I'd like to think that they were able to catch a glimpse of the oncoming storm, you know, headed right at them, and they just got the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah, like, they're like, whoa, is that guy wearing pantyhose? I'm out of here. Overtime's not worth it.
But, I mean, as long as you have, like, just, you know, just this big building and sparks and molten metal, like, you're set, you know?
Oh, yeah, and, man, that end. Oh, my God.
Is it weird that I kind of wanted the Night Slasher to give kind of like the Schwarzenegger Terminator 2 thumbs up as he got pulled into the flames at the end? That's a little weird, right?
On the hook.
Yeah, it's just...
He's on the hook. Thumbs up. So he holds up the knife instead of a thumbs up. It's pretty funny. I'll just be hanging around.
It is, you know, it is a pretty cool ending, though, like, and pretty intense, too. Like, it's weird. I think, you know, throughout the movie, I mean, it feels like a horror movie at times. It feels like an action movie at times. But what's great about the ending is that it kind of feels like finally both at once in that finale. Like, it's tense, yeah, and it's creepy, and, you know, there's some cool jump scares, and but at the same time, it still feels like an action climax, too. It feels like both of those things coexisting at once, and I really dig that about the finale.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it leads to that big showdown between the two characters, you know, Cobra and the Night Slasher, and it was just like any great action film from the 80s, there has to be that inevitable showdown. So yeah, we have that, but we also have the terrifying fight. I mean, it's not just a good guy fighting a bad guy. I mean, it's basically a badass fighting the devil in a lot of ways. I mean, he is so scary in that last scene. I mean, the whole, like, you know, do you want to go to hell with me and all that stuff, you know? And dude, it's still kind of scary to me. Like, it's very, like, unsettling.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, can you think of any other movies in the 80s that attempted to do what Cobra did, which is kind of fuse those two genres? I mean, we've had loads of action horror movies since, but in this kind of way, you know, fusing action and slasher together in that era. The only other one that I can kind of think of, and I don't think it really touches Cobra as far as, like, successfully doing it, but maybe something like the Chuck Norris movie, like, you know, Hero in the
Silent
Tower.
Rage?
Or Silent Rage, arguably, too. Yeah, so... But yeah, something like that. I mean, it feels like, you know, they attempted it. But again, I mean, if you said 80s and slasher and action movie, I mean, inevitably my mind is going to go right to Cobra. But I don't know. Can you think of any others that attempted that?
For me, I mean, the closest thing would probably be Silent Rage because, I mean, it always felt like it was Halloween, but with Chuck Norris. You know, instead of Donald Pleasant. I mean, which sounds weird, but I mean, as an 80s fan, I mean, how can you go wrong with Halloween with Chuck Norris, you know? That, or I mean, it's not 80s, but maybe early 90s. I mean, we already spoke about it earlier, but the first Power, I mean, it wasn't so much an action film, it was more of a drama, but it kind of, you know, brought that cop genre with, you know, this really horror-based story, you know, like good versus evil, you know, a cop versus satanic killer. I mean, that's my bread and butter. I mean, that's everything that I wake up wanting in life.
And where did the first Power end?
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, they all wind up in the same damn building, man.
These warehouses, man. Who works there?
I really dig the first Power. I could talk about that movie for, you know, probably a couple of hours. The fan scene alone is worth all the adoration in the world.
I was about to say that. Yeah, I was about to say that I've never been able to look at ceiling fans the same after seeing the first Power.
It's so good, that scene where he leaps up. Like, I remember being a kid watching it. Probably shouldn't have been allowed to watch it, but I would watch it, you know, after everybody would go to bed. And that would be the one moment where I just kept rewinding. I'm like, how is the fan still working? Rewind. How did he jump that high to get it? Rewind. No, he's really trying to – is he planning on chopping them up with a fan? Rewind. You know, it's
– Everything. And, you know, later on, you know, we had Fallen with Denzel Washington, and I remember watching that in the theater and being like, okay, well, this is basically the first Power. I don't want to watch this.
It was totally the first Power. It was a remake of the first Power, that movie. And I like Fallen. I think it's a cool movie, but it's totally the first friggin' Power. But yeah, but that's, God, 80s action movies. There's a lot to hate about them. There's a lot to love about them. But, you know, I think Cobra gets a lot right, and it's a lot of fun.
It does. I mean, and you know, there's that shot. I mean, I'm not trying to rewind it back to the beginning of the film, but there's that shot where Cobretti goes home, and there's all the cholos trying to give him crap, you know, and he rips the guy's shirt, and there's like a lavalier mic taped to the actor's chest that we clearly see.
What? Okay, I totally missed that.
Yeah, go back and watch that. See, that's something that I never noticed. I mean, I've seen the movie hundreds of times, but I only recently came across that because I think it was Dennis Widmeyer, one of the directors of Starry Eyes, pointed that out on, I think, some form of social media, and I was like, what? How did I not notice that? And I looked at, like, the screenshot, and I was like, yep, that's a lavalier microphone.
I'd like to think that he was just wearing a wire for, like, internal affairs or something. I don't know, but...
Yeah, Andrew Robinson was trying to get the cholo to bust Sly.
Maybe.
Okay, one thing about the Andrew Robinson thing. that's another staple of 80s action films, not interruption per se, but the fact of, you know, saying something really crappy at the end to the hero, and the hero, you know, acts like he's going to walk away and then turns around and punches him.
Yeah.
That was also like a Stallone staple. I mean, we got that in what, like Rocky V, I believe?
Touch me and I'll sue. Come on, bug. Touch me and I'll sue. Sue me for what?
Yeah. That's great.
I'm one of the, I think, 12 people on the planet that actually likes Rocky V. I think it's actually...
Yeah, I think you and Robert Massiantonio, the director of Neighbor, I mean, he has argued with me so many times over that movie.
It's a good...
No, you gotta watch the work print. You gotta watch this. No, I don't.
No, I'm fine with the theatrical. I'm fine with the one that we all got. Now, I will admit, like it, you know, God rest his soul, Tommy Gunn, you know, not the best villain. In fact, not a very good villain at all. In fact, he's probably actually kind of a terrible, you know, villain. He might be the worst villain in the entire franchise. Okay, fine. I get that. But, you know, Rocky going back to the streets, bringing it full circle back to the original movie, the flashbacks with Mickey, him sneaking into the gym at the end and trying on that glove, and the street fight at the end.
No, I understand that. I understand that, but I mean, you go from Rocky or even Rocky Balboa or Creed, and then you look at Rocky V, and it's like Sage Stallone yelling, "You stole my room!" It's like, dude, shut up.
No, I. But
yeah, rest in peace, Sage, too.
Yeah, well, okay, but one thing. Okay, you look at the first Rocky, right? Rocky Balboa feels like a sequel to that movie, right? Creed.
Yeah.
Feels like a sequel to Rocky. Rocky 2 feels like a sequel to Rocky. I would argue that Rocky 5 feels like more of a true Rocky sequel than Rocky 3 or Rocky 4.
I wouldn't have as much of a problem with it as I do if it just wasn't for like the cheesiness throughout of it.
It is pretty cheesy.
Movie. Like go for it. Or like all the awful, awful early 90s, late 80s, early 90s hip hop music. You know, I'm fine with hip hop music. You know, Wu-Tang is my jam. But like the music in Rocky V, oh my God, man! Even as a kid, I remember I was on a school trip to Sacramento to visit the Capitol with my school, and some kid, I don't know why he bought it or even, you know, what the point was. He was listening to the Rocky V soundtrack, and he's like, "Hey, you want to listen to this? It is so bad. It is so bad that it just takes me out of the entire movie."
I'm going to say something that might catch me a lot of hell. Hey, Paul Farrell, if you're out there listening, I just said something might catch me hell, so this is your cue to take a drink. I would take the Rocky V soundtrack over the Rocky IV soundtrack. Give me anything in Rocky V over Hearts on Fire.
You don't like Hearts on Fire?
I hate every piece of music in Rocky IV.
I know, I'm just messing with you.
Oh! Oh,
yeah,
God.
But, man, that montage of training, you know, Stallone has a beard.
Yeah.
Oh, dude,
oh yeah. Yeah,
forever.
It's terrible. Wait, what? Oh, it's – I love the Russian. The robot, Jerry. The robot. The robot servant. Anything in Rocky V is worse than that damn robot.
Yeah, but, like, Rocky getting brain damage, get out of here with that.
Robot.
That should have happened in Rocky 2.
Robot?
Yeah, I guess you have a point. Maybe I'll cave in.
Robot.
But, you know, speaking of the Russian real quick, how cool is it that Drago's coming back for the sequel to Creed?
Wait, what?
You did not know that?
I thought that it was rumored, like, ages ago, but, I mean, is that a definite thing?
No, it's been confirmed.
Oh, that's fantastic. Are they still making it? Because, like, I remember Creed being... I mean, I know we're supposed to wait several years in between any entry in the Rocky franchise, but it felt like Creed was enough of a success, you know, financially and also, you know, critically, that we might have gotten, you know, a sequel straight away. Or, you know, it's already been a couple of years, and Michael B. Jordan is certainly, you know... a busy actor, so I just, fingers crossed, we get it one day. But if we do, you're telling me that they're bringing back the Russian?
Yeah, I mean, the potential for that. I mean, would you know, Creed be going against Drago? Would he go against his son? I mean, this is the guy that killed his father, you know?
Like, it would have to be Drago, I would think. He'd have to fight the guy who killed his dad.
How awesome would that be?
That would, yeah, I love that franchise so much. They could make anything at this point, and I'll be there. So,
and maybe get a cameo from Cabretti there in the audience.
No.
With his toothpick.
No. God, the toothpick. The matchstick toothpick is, I still can't tell if it's awful or brilliant, and I want to lean toward brilliant.
Oh, I love it. And I read somewhere, and I interviewed Refn, and for some reason it slipped my mind to ask him, but I read somewhere that Ryan Gosling having the toothpick in his mouth in Drive was an homage to Cobra.
Oh, wow.
Just like, I mean, Refn has officially said that he wanted to base the driver and Drive off of the shape in Halloween, kind of like this force of nature that doesn't say much and kind of, you know, like, dude, how cool would that be if you know, that was a small little nod to Cobra.
You know, we were talking about a potential follow-up all these years later to Cobra. Now imagine a Refn-directed sequel to Cobra.
I could totally see that. I mean, he has his hand in the remake of Maniac Cop,
which is insane. But
he has a love for the genre.
I just wonder what that's going to look like. Like, I love Maniac Cop for what it is. I don't need a remake, but if that guy is going to produce one, I will be there.
Oh yeah, the same here. I mean, I think if we got a remake of Maniac Cop, maybe it would be closer to like the jump in tone and look that Maniac had from the original. You know, like the original Maniac was very much a New York grimy movie, and the remake was very much a Los Angeles, you know, glossier kind of film. Maniac Cop remake would be kind of like that.
If it's half as good as the Maniac remake, I would be all about that, because that remake sort of knocked me on my ass, and I was not expecting it to.
Oh, same here, especially that soundtrack. Oh my God.
Yeah, very true. So yeah, whether or not we'll get a reboot or remake or maybe a straight sequel to Cobra, who knows? But I, you know, again, it would be kind of hard to imagine a character like him existing as he did then in, you know, modern times. And, you know, it'd be hard for a movie in today's times, I think, to have the same sort of attitude too, because, you know, watching it again, you know, you were talking about Andrew Robinson's character being kind of a stock 80s character, you know, delivering that final line. You know, they're the superiors to our hero who are always sort of standing in his way, just let him do his job, that sort of thing, you know. And there's a sort of like early on, like almost like a villainization, I think, of like, I don't know, quote unquote, like a bleeding heart liberal media type straight away, you know, with that reporter questioning Cobra's methods in kind of the most ham-fisted sort of way early on. And, you know, I think in that way, Cobra is like a traditional 80s hero. You know, he's very shoot first, ask questions later, if at all, you know. And I think he, like most other action heroes of that era, it seems like he very much wants to play judge, jury, and executioner with no regard for sort of like basic procedure. And, you know, it's funny.
Repercussions.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny to think that, like, you know, I don't think even a decade later he'd be playing Judge Dredd and lampooning that sort of, you know, arguably fascist character, you know? And I mean, look, we've had a fun chat. I don't want to delve too deep here or get too dark. But I mean, you know, the movie puts Cabretti in these situations where, yeah, I mean, of course he had to gun down this guy or that guy. And, you know, the movie imagines these outlandish scenarios where Cobra's type of force is always, you know, kind of justified. But I don't know entirely where I'm going with this. It was a stray thought that occurred to me as I was watching the movie again. But
I think I understand what you mean. Like, a lot of that approach with the character and his motives and his lack of caring about repercussions and that stuff, it wouldn't work in the landscape of today, right?
It wouldn't, but also, like, one wonders if, I don't know, one wonders if, say, a certain type of cop on the streets today weren't raised on movies like Cobra, you know, where there's this feeling of, you know, you don't know what it's like out here, whatever I have to do to get the job done, the rules shouldn't apply to me. And, you know, I'm not knocking all cops. I'm not even knocking most cops. Hell, I'm not even knocking many cops. But I mean, fuck, I have good friends who are cops. I just wonder, I mean, a lot of the cops on the streets today would have grown up in the 80s, probably, when these types of movies were so popular. And I wonder, whenever we hear about something really friggin' terrible happening in the news, you know, I wonder –
if they've seen RoboCop, they've seen Cobra one too many times.
I wonder how many of them fancy themselves to be a John McClane or a Martin Riggs or a Marion Cobretti, you know, and I, you know, because the 80s definitely had that sort of run of movies where it said that, look, whatever cops have to do to get the job done, it should be okay. It doesn't matter if their supervisors don't like it. Doesn't matter if they don't follow the rule book. But, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, fuck, even at the end of Cobra, you have that moment where he says, you know, the law stops here and this is where I begin. You know, he's basically telling the killer that he is going to execute him in cold blood, and yet he's still calling himself a cop. You know, and I'm wondering if, you know, you and I – and I'm not saying we're better than any other viewer out there, but I mean, and I'm not even necessarily the type to believe that movies lead directly to any sort of violent acts. No. But you and I and any number of other, you know, listeners to this podcast and any number of other types of viewers can watch a movie like Cobra and we can have fun with it and, you know, think it's a blast and, you know, think it's perfectly, you know, a silly good time. But I wonder if there has been any sort of negative impact with that type of movie having been so prevalent back in the 80s on basically where we're at today, or am I completely silly for thinking something like that?
Well, see, I mean, I've never been a believer that, you know, movies are a good excuse for horrible actions, but at the same time, there are those people who don't know how to separate fiction from nonfiction, you know, cinema and storytelling from real life. And it's not the film's fault whatsoever. It's those individuals who maybe took it a little too far. I don't think you're wrong. I think there are those people, and, you know, and no offense to police officers. I know some police officers too, but I mean, I think maybe that kind of mentality is what kind of has gotten our society into the really awful position that we're in, you know, with so many people taking the law into their own hands, even if they are, you know, officers, you know, thinking that they kind of, they're above the law. And that does kind of go into that whole Cobra mentality. But at the same time, yeah, it is definitely just a film, and it's just a canon film from the 80s that's cheesy as hell, but extremely likable. You know, it's not to be taken very seriously. Whereas, I mean, in real life, there are a lot of people, unfortunately, who do take that kind of mentality to heart, and they put on too much, I think, what's the word? They give themselves too much leeway to do what they want based on having a badge or being in a, you know, authority-like position. I mean, it's not just police officers. I think there's a lot of people, you know, I mean, it goes, I mean, not to get too serious, but it goes into, like, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace. You know, these bosses or these people think they have too much power, that they can do whatever they want because that's who they are. And yeah, the character of, you know, Cobra, you know, Cabretti's like that. But I mean, like you said, it is just a movie. But I mean, yeah, I think that could translate into the real world as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It was a weird notion to strike me, I think, when I was watching the movie again, and I was having fun and I was enjoying it all. And then just that moment made me think, I was like, wait a second. It seemed to be more so than just presenting a character, you know, who is like his own man and he does his own things. And, you know, we happen to be watching a movie about him. It seemed like at times the movie was trying to make a broader point that certain guys like that should be cut more slack or be let off their leash, as it were. And again, I how many movies did we have like that in the 80s? And it had to have created, I think, a certain type of mentality. And I don't know, or maybe it didn't, but I just wonder.
No, I agree.
And I think that's the very reason why we could never – I wouldn't imagine that in a reboot or a remake or a sequel of Cobra that we would ever have those scenes again. I agree
completely. And I nor think should that we. there's two films that kind of have a similar kind of character and approach that are handled very differently. I mean – With Cobra, at the end, you know that there's no chance in hell that Cabretti is going to leave that warehouse with the Night Slasher in handcuffs. You know that. Even if the chance came up, you know Cabretti would have shot him. I'm not saying that's right, but I mean, anyone that sees the film, they know that one way or the other, Cambretti's going to kill the Night Slasher. You know, and there's really no penalty for that. There's no penalty of him taking the law in his own hands. Yeah, I mean, obviously the Night Slasher was a serial killer, you know, depending on how people feel about, you know, capital punishment, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, like, the Night Slasher is a son of a bitch. Like, the world is definitely a better place without him in it in the world of that movie. But
at the same time, you have a film like Kin to Midnight, which is another canon film, you know, the same with Charles Bronson. He takes the law into his hands at the end, too, knowing that that serial killer will do it again. And as he does it, he gets the opposite. Cops come and basically arrest him, you know? That's kind of... It's interesting to see both those movies handle that kind of mentality of, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to get the job done, and handle it very differently.
Well, and I think they're presented, too, as almost being like these, you know, punching your fist into the air triumphant moments, too. I'm thinking of, and it's a great movie, but did you ever see the movie Cop with James Woods?
Oh, yeah, I love that movie.
It's a great movie, but I'm, you know, even the ending of that, I'm thinking of like, okay, yeah, that's another moment where it's like, you know, you as an audience member are supposed to be like on one level kind of like, yeah, you know, but at the same time, like,
being, you're like, wait a second.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And so I don't know. It definitely seems to be a style of filmmaking and a certain attitude and storytelling that died off at some point. Even with, you know, I think you could watch a lot of Stallone's movies in the 80s and come to the conclusion that he's kind of a pretty conservative guy. And yet even in a lot of his later movies, like, you know, I maybe he's still conservative, maybe he's not, but I, you know, at around the time that we were going through the war and whatnot, you know, in the, I don't think it was in the theatrical cut, but, you know, in the director's cut of Rambo, you know, it makes a couple of, you know, very pointed remarks about the war and the kind of men who would, you know, start a war or, you know, promote a war, as it were. And, you know, in The Expendables, I mean, there's a protracted sequence of somebody getting waterboarded, you know, and it's like, I wonder, like, if you gave Stallone the option to do another movie with the Cobra character, I wonder if it wouldn't look quite different, you know, not just in style, not just stripping the 80s out of it, but the type of politics I think that sort of lay underneath the surface. I wonder if even that wouldn't be quite different.
I think, I mean, you know, earlier we were joking about a sequel and I was joking around, you know, Cobretti hunting millennials, but in all honesty, I don't really think a sequel would feel like Cobra. I think if a sequel came out, it would have a very political edge to it, whereas the original was kind of just popcorn fun, you know, scary popcorn fun. It did have some interesting ideas, like we just discussed, about, you know, whether or not to take the law into your own hands and that kind of stuff. But if it came out today, I mean, Stallone kind of, I mean, he definitely has his, you know, he definitely understands what's going on. So I think if he did another Cobra film, it would definitely be, I think it'd be a little more politically driven than the first one would be. And I don't know if that would work per se.
Yeah. I mean, I almost... Yeah, I wonder what that guy looks like. You know, when he did Rocky Balboa, it was very much, you know, what is a prize fighter who fought his whole life and then had that taken away from him, or it eventually just left him? What does he look like in his 60s, you know? With Rambo,
well,
is very much what
say,
is...
Who's to say Cobra wouldn't have eventually went to prison for his actions?
Well, no, that's what I was going to say. I mean, if you know, Rocky was about, you know, watched up prize fighters later days, and if Rambo is about an old soldier, you know, who had one last war left in him. You know, what does a guy like Marion Cobretti look like if he continued to go unchecked? And, you know, maybe he would have gone to prison, or maybe, you know, I wonder if he wouldn't be the villain by this point, you know, 30 years later.
See, that's funny that you say that, because right when you said that, that's the exact same thought that went through my head. What if there was another one and he was more like a vigilante? Because, you know, maybe that kind of thought process that he had in the first film wouldn't have worked these days, so maybe he was kicked off the force. Maybe there's a younger cop. Obviously, he would be played by Ryan Gosling, because he's in everything now that comes out with a reboot, you know, and he'd have to go against Harrison Ford, or not Harrison Ford, you know, Stallone. And, you know, just like I said earlier, we could throw Jared Leto in there just so somebody could shoot him at the end.
It would have to be the zombie squad that goes after Cobra 2, and they would all have to be millennials.
Oh, my God.
It would have to be the millennial version of the zombie squad.
You hear that, Sly? We're writing it right now.
All right. So, well, I think we're getting to the point where we're just about to wrap up. Can I ask before we go, do you have any final sort of parting thoughts on Cobra?
You know, for anyone who didn't give it a chance, I mean, I have friends that think it's the worst movie ever, and I feel like disowning them for that. But, I mean, look at it, listen to this podcast, and look at it through our eyes. You know, or at least try to. It's very much a horror film. It's very much a slasher film. And if you can kind of take the whole, like, oh, this ain't a slasher film because it's not a Jason movie or, you know, a Michael Myers movie. I mean, it's about a satanic gang being badasses, and you have a bigger badass going after them. I mean, it's a horror film and an action film. I mean, look at it again. Revisit it. You know, revisit it a fourth time until you're right, because you're never going to be right until you love the movie.
I can't argue with that. Now, can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future? The book aside, of course.
I'm on Twitter. It's Jerry is just okay. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/ making of Cobra book. So, and you can look it up there, like the page. Yeah, I post updates on there, and, you know, the whole status of the book will be, you know, continually updated and stuff, and I'll keep everyone updated on that.
Very cool. Well, hey, thank you again for coming back and for choosing such a fun film to talk about.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I love the show, like I said.
All right. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, please make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes, leave a comment, and yell at us on Facebook and Twitter. That's at Screamatics, and I am at Jinx1981. Until next time, folks, thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
I personally would have looked for a more subtle solution, but that's not your style. No hard feelings.
No hard feelings, pal.